Well, again, a good afternoon to everyone. I'm Charlie DeLay, Senior Private Wealth Associate with the Chance Pantheon Group. And we're excited on this afternoon to have John Savercool with us for today's call titled Election Canceled. So we certainly not suggesting that, but thought we put a good hook in to get everyone on the line today for what we think is going to be a great call. Just want to remind everyone that your lines are on listen only today. We've gathered some questions already for John prior to this call, but if you would like to submit a question, please just email thechancemantheongroup@ubs.com, including the word the there, during the discussion, and we'll be monitoring that email. Questions are going to be presented anonymously. So with all that in mind, I'd like to introduce Andrew Chance, one of the managing partners of the Chance Pantheon Group, to introduce our guest and begin today's discussion.
Thanks, Charlie. First off, our whole team hopes you and your loved ones continue to be safe and healthy. Joining me today is John Savercool. John serves as managing director and head of the UBS Office of Public Policy. And in this capacity, John directs the firm's lobbying, political, and policy advocacy efforts at the federal level. John's a 34-year veteran of Washington. He's had a number of roles, including working for a congressman and two senators. Many of you know John through his Washington Weekly piece, which we send out, and I believe is the most read report put out by our firm, which is pretty telling. John's always a very busy guy, especially in an election. And now we have the coronavirus pandemic on top of that. So I really want to thank John for spending some time with us today. I also want to apologize in advance, as it seems that they're doing some lawn mowing right now at my house. So I'm going to try and mute myself if it gets too loud, but I will do my best. We're definitely going to talk elections today. I'd like to start by getting a sense of what's going on in D.C. And what you're seeing there. So, John, can you give us an overview of the general tone?
Sure, Andrew. And I just want to make sure you can hear me before I continue talking to no one.
Loud and clear, sir.
Okay, very good. Thanks for having me on today, Andrew. And hello to everybody. And hope everyone is healthy as we try to ride out this storm. Andrew, Washington is today is much like any other big city. It's largely deserted. I'm in my office building right now at 15th and K Streets, and I'm the only one. I'm one of the few in the building, and this is a 13-story building, and we only occupy two floors. But Washington is deserted. I mean, there are pockets of activity in the government, particularly at Treasury and the Fed, where there's people working. The Senate is in session this week. The House is not. But even with that, not all senators have returned, and the activity is limited. If you walk outside, it's fairly deserted. No rush of taxis. No one really walking around except for an occasional person wearing a mask. So it's very eerie. I drive in because I have a better computer at work than I do at home, and it's easier for me to get more done in the office. I'm isolating here. There's no one here. So we're just like any other place in America, or at least any other urban area, where people have been basically told to stay inside and isolate.
Interesting. Well, I certainly hope you're staying safe. You mentioned the Senate is in session and the House is not. Are they maintaining that on purpose, or do you anticipate the House will come back into session?
Well, the House is not in session because they were advised by the House physician that it was unsafe to congregate. The Senate got different instructions from their Senate physician. Both bodies have a physician. And the Senate is conducting hearings in a socially distant manner. Rather than people sitting next to each other, they're 8 or 10 feet apart from each other. And again, not everyone is attending hearings. There are 10 hearings this week covering a wide range of issues. There are even a couple hearings in the House side, even though the House is not in session. The Senate is primarily in session because they want to show Americans that they have a lot of work to do, and they're going to get to it and not let the virus prevent them from getting work done. So, you know, there are some important things at least being discussed. There's some nominations moving through the process that have been long to fill, and the negotiations for a next stimulus package are really just beginning here now.
That's a great lead to my next question. Believe it or not, we had a couple of people had sent in a similar question on, obviously, as you said, the folks at Treasury and Fed have been quite busy and continue to be. What is your sense of what's shaping up for the next round of stimulus? And is that going to be harder to accomplish?
Yeah, so the House and the Senate and the President have signed now four separate bills into law on a bipartisan basis. The total spend is just under $3 trillion. So a lot of money has been spent. Most of this has been to provide relief to the healthcare sector, to state and local communities, to others who have really bore the brunt of the virus. There hasn't been a lot of real stimulus yet to the economy as people are still in relief mode in these bills. So the thought is that the next bill ought to focus more on stimulus rather than relief as our country makes a transition from responding to the crisis in a healthcare way to reopening the economy and making sure that we still have workers and that the economy can still work for the good of all Americans. So this transition is a very loose transition, and it'll differ from state to state. But the thinking is now that this next bill should contain some stimulus, which would be things like, you know, maybe some infrastructure provisions, maybe some tax breaks to stimulate business activity, other things. There will certainly be some relief provisions in this bill as well. And in fact, it may be the majority of the bill. There still is a lot of need out there for different sectors, state and local governments, other kind of first responder workers who have special needs. So it'll be a mix, but this one will be harder because there's less unity on what's needed. When you think of the lawmakers here in Washington, they're starting to see fewer needs and the partisan disagreements will start to settle in. So I think it'll be several weeks before this bill emerges. I think a bill will emerge and I think a bill will pass. And I think it'll be a big bill. I think it'll be a couple $1 trillion, but I think it'll be difficult to resolve. Democrats are going to dig in on specifically state and local aid. They've asked for $1 trillion just for that part of the equation. Republicans have asked for some liability protection. President Trump has asked for some payroll tax forgiveness. So there's other provisions. I mean, there's probably 100 provisions that have been suggested. So it's going to be hard to go through and accommodate all these demands, particularly when so many of the demands come with some big price tags.
No doubt. Let's talk about price tags in a general sense. As you said, just under $3 trillion already been earmarked or spent or in the process of being spent. You're talking about a few trillion more. Never thought I'd throw the word trillion around as kind of carelessly as we do. We hear from many clients a concern about all of this debt, and yet it doesn't seem to be something that's of a concern in D.C. How would you comment on that?
That's interesting you say that because I think in every discussion I've had with clients over the last 6 weeks or so, someone always asks about the deficit. And about how this money, about where this money is going to be, where it's going to come from. And so clearly, sensitivity around deficit reduction is greater among our clients than it is with lawmakers here in Washington. I think that the view in Washington is that we are in this period right now where we are basically trying to put out the fire in a burning building. And the job is to put the fire out, not worry about whether you're doing it properly or whether you're doing it and leaving behind some potential, you know, remnants or just put out the fire and don't worry about water damage or anything like that until later. So that suggests that all this funding will all go in the national credit card. None of it will be offset, and that at some point in the future and in the near future, we're going to have to deal with a deficit that was already approaching $1 trillion for this fiscal year. It will now be triple that. in a federal debt that is soon to be approaching $25 trillion. So Washington hates to engage in deficit reduction. To achieve deficit reduction, you either need to cut tax, to raise taxes or cut spending. There's not a lot of political victories in doing either for constituents. So lawmakers are always loath to do it. Deficit reduction is going to take some courage from lawmakers to do. It's something that is usually done better in a second term of a president. If Trump wins, I guess there's a chance that you could see deficit reduction in a second term. It's hard for a president in his first term, whether it's Biden or whether it was Trump this time. A president in a first term is usually attracted more toward doing things that are generally more popular with voters. Deficit reduction is not always popular with voters because some of the prescriptions are harmful to them or require great sacrifice from them. So I don't know when we're going to get to deficit reduction. It's not going to happen this year or next year probably, but we're going to emerge from this crisis with a deficit that is triple what we projected to have in this fiscal year, and that'll pose challenges for lawmakers down the road.
Undoubtedly. It's interesting. You talked about first terms and second terms. If I'm not mistaken, there's a pretty strong trend of incumbents winning a second term of the presidency. How do things look for President Trump at this point?
Well, the virus really has caused him to change his campaign strategy. In January, maybe as early, as recent ago as the middle of February, his entire campaign strategy was built on a strong economy, strong stock market, and standing up to China and fighting socialism. You might remember that was a period where Bernie Sanders looked like he was more likely to be the nominee than Joe Biden. A lot of those things, a lot of those campaign premises have basically gone. He's not going to be able to run on a strong economy. He's not going to be able to run on a strong market. He can run on standing up to China. And he really won't be able to run against socialism since Bernie Sanders isn't going to be the nominee, although you know, he will try that argument with Joe Biden and maybe whoever his running mate might be. Now President Trump is in a position where he knows he's going to have to run on how he performs in helping America recover from this crisis. And I think that when Election Day comes, November 3 of this year, people are probably going to vote, or most the people whose vote is uncertain right now, and that doesn't include most people in the country. Most people in the country have already decided whether they like Donald Trump or not and whether they're going to support him. And there's about 10 or 15% of the population that is less partisan and is still open to voting for Trump or Biden or someone else. And they're going to watch and see how Trump does in responding to this crisis. And if they like what he's done, then they'll probably vote for him. If they don't, they probably won't. So the election, I think, is going to hinge around his response to the crisis, whether that small tier of voters believes that he is pulling the country in the right direction in recovery mode, and whether he is the guy to put us back on track after going through these months of misery.
So there's a long time to the election, but is there a sense out there for what the grade might be so far in his response efforts?
Well, if you look at polling, and I know some people are suspicious of polling, but we still value polling to a great degree, not necessarily one poll or another poll, but we like to look at the consensus in the overlapping parts of polls that allow us to draw some conclusions. And support for Trump during the crisis response is pretty much mirrors his overall approval ratings, which are roughly 45%. 45% of the public like what he's doing. They approve of the job he's doing. They think he's doing a good job on the recovery. About 50% disapprove of his performance and don't think he's doing a very good job. And then you have 5% of the people who who just don't know, who are up in the air, who still have an open mind about whether he has done well or not. Sometimes people will switch a little bit, but basically you have maybe another 8 or 10% of the public might come off of those percentages and might be persuaded to like them or not like them or whatever. But we're talking about a small group. So I think that it's unclear whether he's done enough to warrant reelection. As you notice, as you mentioned, we still have many months to go. Our experience in the last election was that Donald Trump did better than polls indicated he would. So I always look at a poll, and if I see him at 45%, I add about 5% to that, and that to me is about what he will get in a general election. That was true for the last election. I think it's true for this election. I think he's got to do a little better than he's doing right now, and time will tell whether he gets there or not. You know, if we had this conversation on November 2nd, the day before the election, we would certainly talk about Trump's performance as it related to the corona crisis. But there'd also be other issues that we can't even think about right now will have come up and will shape how people vote. So it's so dynamic. We just don't know all the factors. But right now, I'd say he needs to do a little better to win in some of the swing states where he really needs to win. States like Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin have been among the hardest hit states when it comes to the virus. So they're very sensitive about not only their more vulnerable health populations, but also about the slower economic recovery that will probably take place in those states.
So I think this is, I know there's a lot of people on the call because of my rather inflammatory title. So is there any precedent or possibility that the election could be postponed because of the epidemic or canceled? Or is that a state's issue and not something that the federal government can control?
Well, it is something that's gotten some notoriety because Joe Biden indicated that he thought that the president would somehow postpone the election. That defies, however, the rules that exist and the rules that don't exist, that where there's basically no authority for the president to postpone an election. There is none that I have ever seen or that scholars have seen pointing to any law that gives the president the right to postpone the election. Congress sets the date of the election, and they have done so. And the election is always the first Tuesday of November. Congress could pass a law that would delay the elections if they were so inclined to. In this very partisan environment, it's hard to imagine Speaker Pelosi and Senate Leader McConnell agreeing on a postponement of the election, especially if it benefited one person or the other. I guess if there was a if a nuclear bomb hit the day before or something like that, there could be they might come together and postpone the election. But I think it's an exaggeration to have a concern that the election will be postponed. The 20th Amendment to the Constitution makes clear the terms of presidents and the terms of senators whose terms are expiring, and the president's term expires on January 20th. So if Trump was to try to postpone the election, you know, into early next year, his term would still expire on the 20th of January. That would not change. So that really wouldn't work to his advantage very well. And a third of the senator's terms would expire as well. So there doesn't seem to be any political utility in anyone postponing the elections. The elections will certainly be different. You've noticed over the years that we as voters have experimented more with ways to vote beyond just going to our local elementary school and casting a ballot and seeing your neighbors in the process and, you know, making it a social outing. More people now vote by mail than ever did before. And more people vote early now. Many of us are given chances to vote, not just one time on election day, but eight or nine times leading up to the election. So people are voting in different ways. There are some testing right now for online voting. All these things are somewhat risky because they do have some potential to encourage fraud. But this election will look different because most people will not vote by going to their local school and pushing buttons. They'll vote probably by themselves at home, from home. And we will see a very different election in that sense, but we won't see an election that'll be postponed.
Based on your comments there, I mean, does that increase the possibility of questioning the validity of the election in general? I mean, that's obviously been happening more and more. Does that make it more difficult?
Yeah, it probably does, especially when you rely on mail-in voting. Mail-in voting is traditionally allowed up until the day of the election or the previous day. So once election day, you can't have your mail-in ballot posted on election day. It has to be posted at least the day before. And most ballots are sent in a few days before the election. And naturally, they're not received until well after the election. So they're not counted until after the election. Now, in some states and in some areas, that doesn't matter because the winner is so far ahead that it doesn't matter what the mail-in ballots, what the results are. But in a presidential election, if more than half of our ballots are voted through the mail. And if many of those are late, then they may not be counted. We may not know the winner for several days after the election. So it may not be that we know who the winner is right away. And certainly the loser of the election, whether that's Biden or Trump, would certainly cite the possible fraud and the irregularities of all these other ways of voting. So there would be a challenge just because that's what a lot of losers do, especially in close races. And, you know, maybe they would have legitimate concerns. It's too early to know. But I think it's going to be a very chaotic election, not only competition wise, but the procedures used will make it an election that will be called into question, certainly.
Along that same line, you know, there was an article I saw a few days ago that talked about in the sort of late 1700s to the 1800s, that there was a bit of disdain to see a presidential candidate, you know, campaigning for themselves, and things were obviously done very differently. How do you see them once campaigns really get moving, or how they get moving? What is the effective platform is going to be, and how do you see that playing out in this, you know, very, very strange year?
Well, first of all, I hope you're not suggesting that I was alive from 1700 to 1800, and I would have any direct experience in this, but no, you're right. I mean, it was thought to be beneath the candidate running to go out and make his case and try to be elected. I mean, it was always it was a humble thing for someone to have their name in the ballot and then to win, but not to want to seek the office or to be seen as seeking the office. And in many of our elections, the candidates were determined by the political conventions, which met behind the famous closed doors and would decide who the candidate is based on what the party regulars and the party activists wanted. And now the conventions are really more social events than actually nominating conventions. So the candidates are certainly hampered by their inability to get out and hit the road and engage in a normal campaign where they would spend some time raising money at night in the big cities, and then during the day they would do a couple media events where, you know, hopefully they would get national coverage and have big crowds following them and kind of feed their campaign narratives of them being popular and them getting momentum. Joe Biden is very fortunate to be the nominee of the Democrat, or the very likely nominee of the Democratic Party. He is well known. People in America know him. He is not one of the other candidates who maybe wouldn't be as well known and would still have to go out and basically introduce himself to candidates. So there aren't very many people in America who don't know who Joe Biden is. So in one sense, he's already known. He doesn't have to get out and do a lot of travel. This time down for him might be favorable in the sense that he's getting a little rest. It also keeps him off the trail, so he's not at public events where in the past he's been prone to make gaffes. And this may be helpful to him. At some point, though, he's going to have to do this, come out, and I suspect a couple months before the election, things will open up and regular campaigning will resume. So, you know, he seems to be winning in the polls right now, even though he hasn't really been out doing a lot of campaigning since the last competitive Democratic primary. So it's working for him. Trump is the harder hit candidate because of his change in campaign strategy. He can't run on a healthy economy, and that really works to his detriment. He's got to find some way to make up for that. His afternoon sessions with the health experts have kind of turned into his rallies, where he's getting a lot of viewership, but it's unclear whether he's doing himself any good. And I think both candidates are learning how to figure out how to campaign, how to be noticed, how to make news and positive news while basically staying at home or being socially distant from most people. Trump has the luxury of still doing his job as president. So he's running around doing different things, and that's generating news, but it's very different. And both of them are going to have to learn how to be creative.
I think we all have had to learn how to be creative to some extent. So I knew this question would come from one of our guests on the call. Who are Biden's choices of VP, and who would you pick, John?
So let's start with the premise that he will do as he says, and he will have a female running mate, which he made a pledge to in a debate a month or two ago, and I'd be shocked if he reneged on that. I think when you look at who he ran against in the Democratic primary, the number of women who were in that primary that he will look at, including Senators Elizabeth Warren, Amy Klobuchar, Kamala Harris, Kirsten Gillibrand, I think he'll look at all four of those people. He will look at the defeated Georgia governor candidate, Stacey Abrams. I think there is a congresswoman from Florida, Val Demings, who has been kind of understated, but who impressed a lot of Democrats during the impeachment hearing, will be considered. Now, I think it's likely that he will pick a non-white woman, either Hispanic or African-American woman. I think that's very likely. So that eliminates several people. I think that Kamala Harris, the senator from California, would be the safest choice for him. And I think she would check off a lot of the boxes that he would have in terms of experience, age, compatibility, voting record, things like that. I think she would, I think the temptation might be to pick a progressive liberal type of the Bernie Sanders crowd, but I don't think he will do that because I don't think he wants the charge of socialism to be haunting him throughout this campaign. For that reason, I don't think he'll pick Elizabeth Warren. There are a few reasons why I don't think she would get the nod, but he will certainly consider her. So I think a moderate African-American woman, Kamala Harris, probably best fits that bill. I think she's got a good chance. There'll be others, but I think she's the best position right now, in my view.
Okay, that's helpful. Obviously, in the election, there isn't just the presidential election. What are the other races that we should be watching? Is there an opportunity for majorities to change in either the House or the Senate because of those races?
Yeah, these are really important elections, because regardless of who wins next year, whether it's Biden or Trump, their ability to get their packages through the House and Senate depend on whether they have friendly majorities, and the Senate is particularly the more important body to watch. Republicans have 53 right now. Democrats have 47. They're roughly 35 seats up for reelection. Of those seats, about 10 are potentially competitive. More of the competitive seats in states where Republicans are currently in office. So Republicans have more to lose than Democrats do. And when you look at the handful of real competitive races, it is likely that Democrats will win seats. Even if Trump was reelected, Democrats would likely win a seat or two. If Biden wins, then Democrats are likely to win three or four seats and have the majority. So I think it's very likely that that the Senate will go the way of the White House. It'll stay Republican if Trump wins. It'll go Democratic if Biden wins. Remember, in the Senate, you need 60 votes to pass virtually or most bills. Neither side, whether Republicans or Democrats are in the majority, neither side will have close to 60 to guarantee an easy majority for what the president wants. So the passage of their bills will be difficult. There is a way that sometimes you can pass bills with only a majority. But those are difficult and would some would require some rule changes. Some would require difficulty in trying to craft the right bill. It's possible that if Biden won, he might be able to get some of his agenda through the Senate that most people would view as partisan or, you know, that only Democrats supported. But the big sweeping tax increases that we've heard of, I think those are probably unlikely just due to the fact that there wouldn't be enough support for it. Certainly not 60, and there may not even be 50, depending on how many Democratic senators there are. They may hold the majority with only 50 votes or maybe 51, and I can think of a couple Democratic senators who would probably not embrace, who I know will be around next year, who would not embrace a big tax bill. The House of Representatives is likely to stay in Democratic hands regardless of who wins the presidential election. Republicans will pick up some seats either way. In 2018, they lost a number of seats that they lost just because it was a very bad year for them. They'll likely reclaim many of those districts this year. So Republican gains, but not enough to overtake Democrats as the majority.
Any real big surprises you think could happen out there in terms of those elections? Or is it just that, you know, the 35 seats are up and the, you know, the 10 that are competitive will be where the, you know, where we focus?
I think that the interesting thing will be the continuing changes of many of our states. You know, just 10 years ago, states that you would have identified as Republican-leaning are now Democratic-leaning, and this all occurs because populations change, new people move in, other people move out, some states become attractive because their neighbors are less attractive. So we've seen a lot of Democrats move into Arizona, and Arizona has traditionally been a Republican state. Trump won by 5 in 2016. Colorado recently became a Democratic state. I think it'll be tough for the Republican senator there to win, even though he's a likable guy and hasn't really done anything wrong. He just has the wrong party affiliation per a lot of the new voters in Colorado, particularly younger voters. And then if you flip it, like a couple of states have become more Republican. And we'll likely see that trend continue. Ohio has turned more Republican. Iowa, and maybe we'll see a state even like Pennsylvania or Wisconsin show more Republican support following Trump's wins in those states in 2016. So it's interesting to see how the states change and how they will continue to affect elections going forward. But I think some of the big stories that you'll read about, if we know an election result the day after, will be some of those states. I mean, this election is probably going to come down to six states. And those states are Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Florida, Arizona, and North Carolina. And all the other states are all quite predictable. I'm from the state of Maryland. Maryland's a Democratic state. It will vote Democratic in November. We know that now. Most states kind of follow those suits. And those six states are really the head scratchers that we don't know right now. There are a handful of other states that might be kind of swing states, but right now we're not seeing a lot of evidence of that. So watch out for those six states, and they're the crucial states this year.
That's very helpful, John. I really appreciate your thoughts on this topic, and you know, you've addressed the substantial majority of the questions that we received. And again, really, really appreciate your time and your unique position that is so helpful for us and our clients. So I think with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Charlie. Thanks again for everyone on the call. And Charlie, you can close up the call.
Well, thank you, Andrew. And thank you, John, for your time today. Thanks again, and have a great afternoon.